Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. We are online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and check out our YouTube channel. I'm Kathy Curtis, the Food Matters Forum Chair here in San Francisco, and your moderator for today's program. Caitlin Shetterly is a writer whose work has been featured in Elle, Self, and the New York Times Magazine, as well as on air at This American Life and various other public radio shows. She is the author of several books, including Made for You and Me, Going West, Going Broke, Finding Home, and the best-selling Fault Line, Stories of Divorce. Caitlin is a theater producer, a graduate of Brown University, and lives with her family in her native state of Maine. Her new book, Modified, GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, and Our Future, tells her personal story of how GMOs have impacted her life. Let's welcome Caitlin Shetterly to San Francisco. Okay, why don't we start with the basics? Tell us exactly what is a GMO.
So whenever I answer this question, I try to compare two things. A GMO is something that has the cells from one species have been put inside the DNA from one species has been put inside the cells of another species. And the example I like to use is a frost-proof strawberry, which takes cells from a flounder, which is a fish that is a bottom-dwelling fish, and it likes to stay down by the bottom of the ocean where it doesn't freeze, and you take those cells and you put them inside a strawberry, and then the strawberry will not freeze in frost. I like to compare this to, say, the kind of things that farmers have done for thousands of years, like apple grafting. So you take a Macintosh apple tree and you cut a piece of it off, and then you take maybe a Granny Smith apple tree branch and you attach it to the Macintosh apple tree with some twine, and everything above the graft will make those Granny Smith apples. So these are two very different processes. However, the biotech industry would like you to think they are one and the same. In my opinion, after spending 5.5 years researching this topic, I do not believe they are.
Okay. So it's quite controversial, isn't it, this whole topic of GMOs? And there's strong opinions on the pro side and there's strong opinions on the anti side. Can you summarize that for the audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the pro-GMO side, it's really interesting. Science is really cool. You can do really cool things with corn. Corn is sort of a floozy, I like to say. You can introduce all kinds of interesting bacteria into corn. You can make corn do really neat things. And I think that in this country, we have a lot of interest in science. It's a really big thing. And some people might even say it's bigger than religion right now. So I think the pro side likes to parade out the science of GMOs and confuse a lot of us who maybe don't understand the science with the science, and talk about the science. That word gets thrown in a lot. And I think that they also want to talk about world hunger and how are we going to solve world hunger. I think the people who are against the GMOs, of which I profile both sides in this book, and I try to do it really in as balanced a way as I possibly could. I drove across the Great Plains in our heartland. I went to Europe, and I hung out with beekeepers there, and I also spent time in the European Parliament. And then I came to California and spent time in the labs of two scientists here at Berkeley. And throughout that work, what I found that the anti-GMO people were saying was they also had a lot of science, but somehow their science was getting drowned out, and there was nobody to connect all the dots of their science against the pro-GMO science. And I think that a lot of people are very concerned about what we're doing environmentally. One of the things that doesn't get talked about in this argument of the GMO and the labeling is the pesticides and the incredible uptick in pesticides that has occurred since the advent of the GMO. And I think that people are concerned about the climate. Our agriculture, the way we're growing our food, is probably the biggest thing changing the climate right now. And it's affecting our water, our air, our soil. So these are some of the basic concerns that I think the people who are against GMOs have, not to mention the incredible power these companies have. 90% of our seeds are sold by the chemical companies. There seems to me that that's an inherent conflict of interest. I'll leave that to you to decide. But and now with the Monsanto-Bayer merger, one might argue that they are also going to be making the medicines that we may need if we all get sick. So controlling our food on the planet is probably the most powerful thing, maybe more powerful than bombs or anything else that a company can do.
How did the big companies get their foot in the door? This country used to be a country of small family farms, right? And agriculture has been a huge part of our country's history. But something must have happened to let these big companies in the door to create these products. There must have been a reason why they felt there was a need for them. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the inception of the GMO?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of things happened at once. But one of the things that became incredibly clear to me when I was driving across the Great Plains, which I did in the fall of 2013, I flew to Denver and I drove across Nebraska and through Iowa and interviewed people as I went. And what I hadn't realized until I was there, seeing the landscape, I felt like if I was going to write a book about GMOs, I had to go see these corn cities. I had to go see these crops. I couldn't just write about them as if they were this other without experiencing them. I think that many of us on the coasts, we sort of otherized, if that's a word, the people in the center and also these crops. And that's why the first section of the book is called Flyover Country, because actually it's a farmer who points that out to me when I'm in Nebraska. So when I was driving across the Great Plains, I realized in my interviews and also just seeing it with my own eyes that we are not that far away from the Dust Bowl. The Dust Bowl really wasn't that long ago. And some of these farmers, that was their grandparents or maybe even their parents who lost everything. They might have even, someone in their family might have even lost their lives, certainly their livelihoods or their entire farms. And so, you know, a lot of things happened after the Dust Bowl. The Ogallala was tapped and we began to use that aquifer. And then at the same time, sort of when the big agrochemicals companies came in and said, don't worry, we've got you. You will never have to worry about drought again. You won't have to worry about pests again. You don't even have to till your soil. It'll never blow away. The Dust Bowl was so recent and still so prescient and still such a fearful and painful memory that I think that that part of the country was completely, completely open to this idea. They needed someone to come in and fill that vacuum. Interestingly enough, FDR during the Depression had actually been that person for them to say, don't worry, we've got you. We've got your back. But the chemical companies came in, you know, later and basically said the same thing, and they wanted that assurance.
Didn't World War II change everything as far as this chemical nitrogen and using fertilizers, and Monsanto really came into being then? It was called the Green Revolution. You refer to it in your book.
Yeah, the Green Revolution was anything but green, as we might think of green these days, those sort of composting lobster shells or something like that, which we do a lot of in Maine. But it was about chemical production and, producing these large swaths of green agriculture across the globe and using a lot of chemicals in which to do it. And that was really set the stage for the adoption of widespread chemical use agriculturally worldwide.
Right. I don't think you can talk about GMOs without talking about Roundup, right? They go together hand in hand. You have GMO and you spray there's an insecticide in the GMO, mm-hmm. but you need a herbicide to kill the weeds, right?
Right.
So Roundup comes into the picture. And the chemical name is glyphosate. And there are studies that have shown that it causes cancer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if that's proven yet, but I think that that's in the news a lot right now, even after all these years of using Roundup.
Yeah.
What did you find in your research?
Well, it certainly
that?
Has been a proven carcinogen. The World Health Organization, the American Cancer Research Society, has also said this, and many European countries suspect this. But certainly, yeah, glyphosate is a carcinogen. It's certainly linked to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and there's a whole list of other cancers that they suspect. But the incredible uptick in the use of glyphosate is something that we really should consider. We are now using, interestingly enough, glyphosate sales stopped being recorded in 2007 under the Bush administration. But it's estimated that we are using at least 250 million pounds of the stuff annually. But you have to understand that there are lots of other pesticides that we're also using. So now some people say that it's more like 527 million pounds of pesticides are being used, herbicides in general. So the uptick in the use of glyphosate is incredible. As you probably all realize, these crops are genetically engineered to withstand the use of glyphosate, which kills all the weeds around, including milkweed, which of course has affected the monarch butterflies. And so when you engineer a crop to do this, you can use these herbicides with reckless abandon. Pesticide is sort of the overarching term for fungicides, pesticides that are actually for pests and herbicides.
Now, I read something interesting in doing research to talk to you, and that is that the FDA is finally going to start testing food for glyphosate. And this is just recently, the first time in their history. I mean, they test for other chemicals, but never glyphosate. I find that incredible after all these years. And I wonder what changed that they are now going to start testing it.
Yeah, I mean, I could only guess what
it
might
could
have
be
changed.
These studies with the World Health Organization.
I would think so. And I think, you know, there's a lot of evidence out there that, for instance, glyphosate stays in the soil anywhere from 22 to 38 years. We have super weeds, which have become resistant to glyphosate. And yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the farmers in the middle of this country were told that essentially glyphosate was as safe as water. It wasn't a big deal. And whenever I hear that, what I try to remember is something that one of the scientists in my book said to me, which was, you know, I asked him essentially the same question, like, is this a bad thing? And he looked at me and kind of laughed and said, look, if it's designed to kill something, of course it's not safe. And I think we all forget that. We just think, well, our regulatory agencies are on top of this, and of course this wouldn't be used if it's going to hurt us. But you do have to kind of think through, like, if this is going to kill something, is it going to be completely non-toxic? I don't know. I think that's a question we all need to be asking.
So this brings up Rachel Carson, one of your influencers, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
She wrote the book Silent Spring. I don't know if anyone in the audience read that book, but after it came out, DDT was banned in the U.S., right? And the EPA was started. So how did she influence your work?
Oh, in so many ways. I mean, so Rachel Carson, you all know, she wrote Silent Spring, which came out in 1962. It became an immediate bestseller. And at the time that she wrote it, she was dying of cancer, actually, and she died 2 years later. But she went on the road to talk about it. She was attacked vituperatively by the chemical industry, by the way, and they, you know, accused her of sort of cultish nature tendencies and accused her of being a hysterical woman. And But she felt that this was so important to do. And it's true that in her wake, DDT was finally banned, and the modern environmental movement was begun. And that was exceptional. One of the things that Rachel Carson says, which actually opens my book, is, and I'll just read to you, is, and I just love this thing that she said, is, man is a part of nature, and his war against nature is inevitably a war against himself. And I think that that's perhaps one of the most prescient things she said. However, what's interesting is that other than DDT being banned, you can open up Silent Spring today, and almost on any page, the message is still relevant, and a lot of those same chemicals and same pesticides are being used. And that is really shocking to me. We are 54 years after the publication of her book. Book was published on September 27th in 1962, and here we are in this situation where we currently have 85,000 chemicals in circulation. At the time that she wrote the book, it was 500 chemicals a year were being made by the chemical industry, to which she said, our bodies need to adapt to chemicals that are outside the limit of biologic experience. Not only our own bodies. I mean, I even worry about, you know, of course I worry about my own two little children, but I worry about the innocent animals that, you know, this is coming to, and plants and everything else on the planet. But now that number is more like 770 to 800 chemicals a year that the industry is making. So we have to think about, so if these chemicals can be made much faster than we can evolve, or anything can evolve. And that's a serious concern. So yes, Rachel Carson, she was on, I had sort of two people on my shoulders while I was writing this book. And one was Harriet Tubman, you know, when the dogs are coming, keep going. And my husband was sort of the voice of reminding me of Rachel, of Harriet Tubman. Every time I would say, oh man, you know, I was really a chameleon. I'd be on the phone with someone who was from the biotech industry, and they would convince me completely that GMOs were fine and everybody else was crazy. Then I'd get off the phone and I'd sort of be quiet, and I'd probably be putting one of my children to sleep, and I'd start to have some questions about what they had said. And I'd go back and call them back and make them angry at me by asking more questions. But I had the same thing with the anti-GMO people too. I had questions kind of on top of questions. And I would say to my husband, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? And he'd say, just keep going. And just keep going. It's the gray area. It's the nuance. It's the questions. That's the book. And it is. The book is a series of questions. But Rachel Carson was on my other shoulder. And I feel that she was also, you know, the person who was telling me to keep going, that we needed to ask these questions. How did all this happen? How did this book become an immediate bestseller? How was it like a glass of cold water really thrown on the consciences of so many Americans? And yet, our chemical production was amped up. How did that happen? Interestingly enough, TSCA was formed in her wake, which is the act that was supposed to regulate chemicals. But there were so many loopholes in it that it actually did the opposite. It actually opened doors and made it easier. So that was pretty interesting.
I want to talk about how your experience in writing this book and is compared to hers, where she was thought of as crazy and outrageous. And you'll get to tell your story a little bit later about why you wrote this book, but you wrote an article in Elle magazine called The Bad Seed, The Health Risks of Genetically Modified Corn. And it described your health issues. And what surprised me, I read the article, it was a very interesting article, I thought very well written, not too strong, opinionated, and just, it was a story, basically. And then I started reading the reaction to the article, and I was so shocked at how condemned you were for your opinions in this article. And I think there were a couple people that wrote, and it turns out, as I found out in my reading, that Monsanto might have hired these people to write these articles in response to yours. So if, you know, if that's going to be the reaction, how is this story? I mean, Rachel Carson was able to produce a bestseller, and lots of people learned about this, and things changed. How does that compare to your experience now in writing this book and the reaction that you're getting in writing this book?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how this book, what you know, it's only been out for a couple of weeks, so I don't have any idea what the long-term reaction to the book will be. I can say there has been some, what seems to be perhaps some media silencing of the book, and that's been a little concerning. I think that discrediting and silencing are two tactics that are often used. I think that the chemical industry has gotten really wise since Rachel Carson published Silent Spring about how to handle situations like this. But, you know, there was a piece in the Times today about how the, Coca-Cola and Pepsi were silencing health critics of soda. And what about the sugar industry or tobacco? I mean, we don't, you know, we have lots of these stories right by now. We know how this works. We know how the industry silences and discredits and Trump sort of parades out their own science to squelch anything else, any other concerns or science that could be out there. So I think that that's pretty common, and I haven't not expected that.
Right. Now, are there any studies that definitively prove that GMOs or any of these chemicals are bad for your health at this moment in time?
Okay, so we have to separate the two out.
Yeah, okay.
Obviously, the chemicals, absolutely. The bigger concern is that we don't have the funding or the staff in our regulatory agencies to connect the dots. So my book, again, is a series of questions. I bring up some really important studies about GMOs, studies you've never heard of. And I bring up some really important studies about the pesticides themselves, studies you also may not have heard of. But, you know, one of the Monsanto sort of spokespeople, former scientist, there was a whole piece in the New York Times a year ago about how he was actually at least given perks, perhaps funded indirectly by Monsanto, to go out and talk about his science, their science, in order to convince the American people that there's nothing wrong with GMOs. So I did interview that guy. His name is Bruce Chassie. And Eric Lipton, who's a terrific reporter for the Times, also wrote about him and these emails that were discovered in a FOIA that the U.S. Right to Know campaign got. He basically said something really elucidating to me. I asked him why our regulatory agencies weren't connecting these dots and why weren't they doing the research or why weren't they at least looking at all the industry research. And he laughed at me and he said, because for every study, they'd have to back up two tractor trailer trucks of research and nobody's got the staff or the money. They can't look at that at any of these regulatory agencies. So you have to understand, so that we are trusting the industry to do the research on these products. Shelley Pingree, a congresswoman from Maine, my home state, who has gone up against these big biotech companies and made herself very unpopular with them, she said something to me that I think is so true and so interesting, so true based on the research I did, which was that she said, with the FDA, you know, with drugs, we have to prove that each drug is safe on every single mouse on the planet, essentially. But with these chemicals and these pesticides, we have to prove that you're going to fall down and die tomorrow. Another scientist in this book says, we are the ultimate animal study. And I would take that a step further. And I'd say that our children are the ultimate animal studies. And that really concerns me. As a mother, it worries me. I'm really concerned about this planet and what we're doing to the environment, and I'm concerned about what we're doing to our children.
So the same question is, can the public see any of these industry studies that have been done?
No, you and I will not have access to those studies.
No. Okay. So really, the industry can't say that their science is better than the other side because we don't see what their science either, right? I mean, we're not seeing their research.
No, no, we're not. However, some of that may change. There was a new law and it passed this summer where the EPA is going to try to start testing some of these chemicals at an incredibly slow pace. However, when they do it, they're going to make studies available to the public. So that may change things a little bit, and I think it'll be pretty interesting how that works, but that hasn't gone into effect yet, and I don't know exactly how that's going to shake down.
Okay. And in your book, you talk about the industry studies. There are two, this is what you're saying, that they have to prove that you're going to die tomorrow. They're like 2 months of study. That's it. It's not a year-long study. It's like 3 months they'll study the effect of this GMO on, I don't know, a rat or whatever. And
yeah, there aren't a ton of long-term feeding studies. And the biggest bone of contention that a lot of scientists have is that the industry keeps saying the animal model is not valid. It's not valid. It's not valid. It's not valid. Okay, well, so we're animals and we're consuming these products and we're living in communities where pesticides are being sprayed. And yet it seems to me the animal model is valid if we're animals. Like, for instance, atrazine, which is a pesticide used on corn, it can be used on non-GMO crops. So just because you've bought non-GMO doesn't mean you aren't buying something that's laden with pesticides. So atrazine is a really interesting endocrine-disrupting chemical. And so in some communities where atrazine is sprayed, there are congenital defects to the male sexual organs. You can't go back and do a detox or a redo. This is lifelong. It's changed something. The changes that are going on genetically due to some chemicals as well, affecting the epigenetics of people and what you're passing in your bloodline, these are irreversible changes. We can't do a do-over. So we need to start thinking about this.
So on that positive note, let's talk a little bit about what you have done in your life to not be exposed to these chemicals. Your story is really interesting. And I have to say about this book, we're talking a lot of science and GMO and chemicals, but this book is really a real personal story of Caitlin's. It's a really excellent read. And I want you to talk a little bit about that. You wrote this book and you wrote that article in Elle because you got sick. So could you talk about that a little bit and
sure.
what you, changes you made in your
do
diet?
Do you still want me to read the very beginning of the book?
Yeah, that'd be great.
So Kathy's asked me to read a couple of sections to you. I hope you don't mind being read out loud too. So this is the first chapter in the first section, which is called Flyover Country. And this, I think, sets the stage for the book. The blue Nebraska sky stretched above my car like a tight rubber band. The wind held its My Antonia constancy, and the sun beat down. All around, as far as the eye could see, were dusty brown fields of dried soybeans and golden fields of dried corn. There were no trees, just that huge open expanse of soy and corn crop after soy and corn crop, alternating gold and brown and open to the big blue sky. Tractors glinted in the sunlight like ships at a distance, sailing up and down, methodically cutting ribbons out of a sepia ocean while dust billowed like a thick and impenetrable storm behind me. Harvest time. The day before, I had landed in Denver, Colorado, in the late afternoon. When I deplaned and exited the airport, standing for a moment on the hot, dry concrete sidewalk outside the baggage claim, my rolly suitcase gripped in my right hand and my black L.L. Bean backpack on my shoulder, I was suddenly and immensely thirsty. I looked up and saw the Rocky Mountains rising, snow-capped and gleaming before me. They seemed so close. I wondered if I could just reach my arm through that horizontal and relentless sun, if I'd be able to dip my hand into that snow, bring a handful to my mouth, and cool off. As I turned away from the mountains toward the rental car lots, the land before me stretched as flat as paper across the great plains of eastern Colorado and into Nebraska, where I was headed. I had come to Denver to start somewhere. to start telling a story that I'd stumbled upon in that life becomes art and art becomes life kind of way. 2 months earlier, I'd published an article in Elle magazine about a long and tedious illness that had plagued me for nearly 4 years until I met Dr. Paris Mansman, an allergist and immunologist. Mansman is based in the suburban town of Yarmouth, Maine, a short distance outside Portland, our state's biggest city and cultural center, where I lived. Mansman had asserted that, in his opinion, I had developed a sensitivity to the proteins that are created from the DNA inserted into GMO corn to make it herbicide resistant and also to carry its own pesticide. These genetic aberrances, he posited, had caused my immune system to go haywire. Although his theory seemed unorthodox, perhaps crazy, and it turned out also majorly controversial, I decided to trust in it. I was too desperate not to. I'd been sick for so long during the first year of my marriage and for the entire first 2 years of my son Marzi's life. And by sick, I don't mean that I was just not feeling great or that I was a little queasy. I mean that I was so sick that I was often unable to get out of bed because arthritic pain radiated throughout my body, making my thighs and ankles weak and causing me to hobble around like a 90-year-old. My ankles, I joked to Dan, my husband, felt like they'd been Kathy Bates'd, a reference to the movie Misery. I was exhausted, yet my body was in such a state that I felt like I'd been plugged into an electrical outlet and couldn't relax enough to sleep. I had horrible headaches, a constant head cold, tingling and numbness in my feet, legs, and arms, and rashes splattered like pizza sauce across my face. During this time, I had tried every diagnosis or theory that came my way, including hormone treatments, vitamin injections, iodine pills, elimination diets, and a long and debilitating course of powerful antibiotics aimed at curing me of chronic Lyme disease. Everything seemed to make me sicker, not better. I felt like Christina in that famous Andrew Wyeth painting. The world was just out of reach. My life was passing me by while we spent thousands and thousands of dollars we really did not have to consult with anyone who would see me, from Harvard-educated MDs to shamans. All the while, we were just hoping someone would find a key to unlock this puzzle and make me well.
Okay, and that's what started your journey on this, is in healing, and you healed yourself, right?
Well, that was what was uncanny about the whole thing. So because I'm really kind of a pain in the neck of a person, I took the GMO corn, which he suggested, out of my diet, and like 2 weeks later, I felt better. It was uncanny.
That wasn't that easy to do, though, right? I mean,
it wasn't. So here's the thing. So this is back to the pain in the neck. But I was skeptical. I was like, does this make any sense? We changed our diets. It turns out that there are over 250 substances, even in organic foods, prepared organic foods, that are made from chemicals that are non-organic, and they're often made from GMO corn and soy. Anything that's prepared possibly could have corn in it. Corn's in baking powder. It's in your iodized salt. GMO sugar beets make, you know, something like 80% of our sugar at this point. And sugar beets, GMO sugar beets, also carry their own pesticide, and they're also Roundup resistant, and they're also sprayed with glyphosate and other things. So these, you know, once we sort of changed our diet to get away from this, we took our arm and went to the table, and a lot of things fell off. So the question of my book was, okay, so this is interesting, but because I'm a pain in the neck, I was skeptical, and I kept going and asking more questions, and I wasn't sure. And those questions are throughout the book, and I don't ever wrap this book up with a, like, bingo, I'm sure this is what made me better, and I'm sure this made me well, but it was surprising that I got better that quickly. Let me put it that way.
So did you cut out all grocery store packaged foods?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's GMOs in almost everything.
Almost everything.
My understanding anyway is mm-hmm. there's no way to know that because they're not labeled, but pretty much there's corn or soy in just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you couldn't use jar, and you have kids, right? Mm-hmm. So you had to prepare family meals and all that. So what did you do?
It's been a really wonderful journey. I mean, we began canning our own food, and, you know, the farmer's market, you know, instead of sort of a fun Saturday activity, maybe for a cool dinner on Saturday night, became our lifeline. It became, you know, if let food be thy medicine, Hippocrates' statement was something to think about. These became words to live by for us. And we began sourcing, you know, a part of a grass-fed cow that we went into with friends. And we found a chicken farmer who was growing chickens that were, you know, raised outside on pasture and used very little corn. And the corn he used was organic, et cetera, et cetera. And so I talk about all that in the book. I introduce you to the farmers that we got to know. We bought grass-fed dairy. And we just completely changed our lives. Now, it actually was wonderful and not that much more expensive. I think one of the things people are afraid of is this is going to be really expensive. It actually, and I enumerate this, it actually is cheaper because you're paying for all that packaging and prepared food. And so we would buy, for instance, tomato seconds from a farmer we knew, tomatoes that maybe weren't perfect looking. We'd make our tomato sauce for the year or our own jams, things like that. So it's actually been a really wonderful experience. We know our farmers. Our kids know our farmers. They are household names. And this is what we do every Saturday is we go and procure our food for the week, and we interact with these people who are the stewards of not only what we eat, but our health. And we can ask them questions, which, you know, there's an allergist in the book who says to me, you know, why would you ever have thought that someone in some office is going to feed you better than what your grandmother would have fed you? And when he said that to me, I sort of was like, well, I don't know why I ever would have thought that. You know, I don't know. We haven't asked ourselves those questions, or at least I hadn't.
It's time for a reminder for our radio audience. This is a Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to author Caitlin Shetterly about her new book, Modified, GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. I'm Kathy Curtis, your moderator. You can listen to Commonwealth Club programs on the radio or podcast, watch our YouTube channel, check out our website, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. So talking about what the foods you prepare for your family, do you think if there had been labels on the packaged foods in the grocery stores, it would have been easier for you to continue to eat the way you were? Would you have wanted to do that? What is your opinion?
So a lot has changed in the last few years. So this was back in 2011. And actually, interestingly enough, after my piece came out in Elle, I really saw an increase in labels identifying corn. The FDA does not require that corn be labeled. There's a corn allergy Facebook group, and they have like 56,000 members or something like that, and yet the FDA does not label corn as an allergen anywhere. So yes, I've seen this change. You now can see labels that say, you know, maltodextrin made from corn or whatever. So I think maybe now it would be easier, I guess, yes. Is that what you asked me?
No. If the food was labeled,
yeah.
I mean, there was no
I mean, the non-GMO label, okay, is one thing. It's just because something isn't GMO doesn't mean it wasn't sprayed with pesticides. I guess the only label that really works and makes any sense is the organic label. You know, we have a problem in this country, which is that organic seems like it's really for the Volvo driving Eileen Fisher wearing set. Eileen Fisher is interesting because they're making organic clothing now, actually, as well. Clothing maybe we all can't afford, but it's interesting. Cotton is another big GMO crop. Organic is the only label that really will tell you. And I think that one of the things that I discuss in this book is that mothers were interviewed about what they wanted to feed their children, their babies. And mothers across educational levels, across different ethnicities, different income levels, they all wanted to feed their babies the organic baby food, all of them. And I think that that really is important to note, that there's no mother out there really that doesn't want the best for her children, that does not want to give her child the healthiest thing. So we have to find a way in this country to make organic available to everyone. Or we have to find a way to grow our crops in a more sustainable and less toxic way.
About the organic thing, farmers can grow food without being certified organic and still follow all the practices that an organic farmer would.
Right.
I think people should know that, because there's, like, at the San Francisco Farmers Market, it's not an organic market, but all of those farmers' practices are sustainable, and they don't use pesticides, chemicals, but they're not certified organic. So it's very confusing, the whole organic, non-organic. And
the only way to really, and again, this brings you back to sort of buying food from someone that you can look at and ask questions, is to ask your farmer questions. And that can be really intimidating, even for me, who's been doing this now for over 5 years. But I think that there's a real power in that. What did you use on this crop? What does that do? Why do you use that? How do you grow this? Those are some really legitimate questions that I think, you know, how we buy our food and what we feed ourselves may be a very important act of public resistance. And we should think about it that way.
And it's true that even if food is not GMO, it could be sprayed with chemicals too.
So, absolutely, yeah.
Right? So that's why you're saying organic or organic-like, sustainably raised food is really the only way you're going to know whether you're not eating these chemicals or...
Yeah, what no one's been able to do as far as the research goes is separate out the GMO itself from the pesticides. And you know, they're or connect these dots. And so, we need to start thinking in this country, I mean, to use a Bush term, the collateral damage, the sort of the synergistic effect of all these things. You know, when you're, and I go into this when I'm in Nebraska with a lovely farmer named Zach, who I spent some time with, who is a GMO farmer. And when he describes to me, and that's in the book as well, all the chemicals that he uses on his crops, you know, this isn't just one chemical. It's not like he just uses glyphosate. Well, we've got superweed, so we also have to use 2,4-D. We also have to use atrazine. We also have to use this. We also soak the seeds in neonicotinoids. So, you know, there are all these different chemicals that are used on one crop, and it's nobody's job in this country, by the way, to look at how these all interact with each other. And we're getting traces of all of those chemicals when we eat them. The other thing to mention is that GMO corn, for instance, is registered by the EPA as a pesticide, not as a food. However, it's you know, we live in a cornucopia. It is our corn is our it's ubiquitous in our American foodscape. So, you know, how these things are connected to each other, and the fact that the big multinational companies that make the seeds also make the chemicals that go with them, and with Bayer, we're going to get a little further down the line there with what they do. I think that we need to think about how those things all interact.
Can you talk about Zach a little bit more? I thought that was such a great story, because you really liked him.
Oh, yeah.
And he really believes in what he's doing, right? He believes in that way of farming. Why do you think that? Why does he believe in it? So it's not just his livelihood, right? He really believes he's doing something good.
Well, I don't want to spoil the end of the book, because, of course, Zach has an evolution in the book. But Zach was this, super handsome, young, charming GMO corn and soybean farmer that I spent the day with in Nebraska, and I spoke with throughout the writing of this book. And his family has been in Nebraska for generations. And reading his story, if you read the book and listening to his story, it became really clear how he came to the point where he wanted this technology and what he thinks is cool about it. But he has a real evolution through the book, and he comes back around in the end. And he became someone who I trusted and thought was a really important voice to hear. Because I think that we think of these people growing our food as something other than ourselves. And Zach says, you care about the same things that I care about, which is that my kids are eating the same food your kids are eating, and I want it to be safe for my kids too. He starts to think about some of those questions the more I harassed him throughout the years I was writing this book. And he has some interesting changes.
I'm going to go to some audience questions. And this question about GMOs being able to feed the world's poor and create more food security in the world and all that, that keeps coming up. And I think that's what a lot of pro-GMO people, that's their standard, mm-hmm. that we're going to be able to grow more food and feed everyone. So what is your response to that?
So GMOs, we've been growing them since, depending on how you look at it, from the early 90s or the late 80s, you have to understand that whenever a GMO crop comes onto the market, it's already been in field trials for at least 15 years, probably. So that means it's grown in the open air in a plot, and birds and bees and animals and humans are interacting with it. And maybe this little plot's being grown for this chemical, and maybe it's going to be drought resistant, or it's got some other cool things it's going to do, and this plot is doing something else. And, you know, corn is sort of a floozy, like it'll cross-pollinate. You can do all kinds of neat things to corn, and it also in the environment, it'll do neat things with itself. We've been growing these crops now for quite a while, and we have more food insecure people on the planet than ever before. Over 1 billion people, and that's a conservative number. We have food rotting, piles of corn and soy in the middle of this country. We throw away at least 40% of our food in this country. We have many food insecure children in this country. We have to ask ourselves, are we feeding the world? We need to ask these questions. Why are these numbers going up? And why are some people making more money and controlling our food to a larger and larger extent, and yet we have more children who are malnourished, who are hungry, more lactating mothers who need food? These are the people I think about. And these are the questions I ask. Now, I pose this as an open question because, again, my book is a series of questions, and I have my own opinions about it, but I'd be interested to see those of you who have that question, if you read the book, what your questions would be, or maybe you'll make your own answers. And I can't wrap this up in a nice little bow, unfortunately. I think that we need to ask questions.
And going back to farming, farmers are very much affected by GMOs because Monsanto and other companies control the seed, right? Mm-hmm. Traditionally, farmers could save their own seeds, and that was how agriculture was done in the United States. Now, they can't so much. Can you talk about this whole seed issue in farming and what's happening to small farmers especially?
I think the thing I'd like to talk about that is the bigger issue is how this affects organics. I think that the organic farmers cannot be protected from contamination of these crops. That's the biggest issue. You can't keep, these plots are right next to each other. You can't keep your crop separate from what is being sprayed over here or what's being grown over here. And I think you have to remember these things are out in the open air bees travel 4 miles or farther. Birds, you know, there's a tomato that well, the first GMO food was a tomato. And, you know, when there's a scientist in here named Belinda Martineau. And when she was working on it with the FDA, actually, when people came in and tested this tomato, it was a tomato that was bred to not go soft on supermarket shelves. The people who tasted the tomato came in and tested, they had to spit out what they were chewing because the idea was they could go and deposit the seeds into the outside environment. Well, let's just think about this. If we're growing these crops and covering the middle of this country with them, in particular, or the planet, really, birds, bees, everything's coming in contact with these. We are not hermetically sealing these crops until we know more about them. So I think contamination is a big issue. But yes, there are some really apocryphal stories about how farmers were harassed by Monsanto, and then there are the stories the technology inside the seed is patented, and so you cannot reuse the technology.
And they have to buy the seeds every year.
They have to buy the
right?
seeds every year. So and they have to buy the pesticides that go with them as well. And this has become a big issue in India because farmers are going broke buying the seeds and then the pesticides to go with them. And then if something happens like drought or flooding or whatever, they lose everything and then they have to mortgage their lives against the next year. And some people claim, and this is a question in my book, but some people claim, and I heard both sides of this argument, that this has led to the increased incidence of suicides with Indian farmers.
That was an audience question.
Oh, yeah. Some people claim that, and I do present both sides of that argument in this book. So,
well, there's even a local story about seeds. The Early Girl tomato seed was bought by, I don't know if it was Monsanto, one of the companies, and there are farmers that are farming sustainably that grow Early Girl tomatoes, but they don't agree with the practices of the big companies. But if they want to sell Early Girls, they have to buy the seed. So one of these farmers is trying to grow his own tomato that he doesn't have to buy. But it's tough. I mean, it's really tough to start your own tomato from seed and have it taste as good and all those things. So I think it really does affect the small farmer quite a bit. That doesn't want
it,
to work
it affects
with
the large-scale farmer, too. I mean, these guys, you know, their equipment is expensive, the pesticides are expensive, the seeds are expensive. You know, one little hiccup and, you know, they could lose everything.
Yeah, right.
There's an incredible Frontline documentary called The Farmer's Wife, I believe, and it's about a Nebraska farming family trying to do this. And in the Great Plains, and it's, you know, you really understand how hard it is after watching that.
There's another audience question about what other crops. We keep talking about corn and soybean, but mm-hmm. there are other crops. Cotton is one. What are other crops that are GMO or
so,
primarily?
This is the
GMO?
Thing. I mean, when we are discussing the GMO and when the, you know, this is the interference that this is how it makes this conversation so hard to have. We are blanketing the planet with three crops, essentially, three GMO crops, which are dependent on the chemical pesticides and which are also, corn in particular is a huge water hog, GMO corn, organic corn, not as much. So these three crops are corn, soy, and cotton, right? And sugar beets, kind of like. And they all carry the insecticide BT inside of them. And they all are Roundup resistant, okay? But then there are all these other GMOs which always get sort of paraded out when we have this discussion just to make it confusing for all of us. And there's the GMO papaya, for instance, or there's a GMO wheat that's being developed in China to resist certain funguses so that we would have to use less fungicide. There's the golden rice. There's the GMO mosquito, right? We're talking a lot about Zika recently. There are two kinds of GMO mosquito that are currently being developed. I think there may be a question of the good GMO, but what we have to ask in every single case, and this is why my book is called Modified, is as we modify the environment, we modify ourselves. We have to understand that. As we have eradicated everything which has displeased us, we are affecting our own survival, our own children's survival. My survival is as tied to that milkweed plant and that monarch butterfly and that polar bear as it is to, as yours is. And we just forget that. And I think that we have to take this a case-by-case basis, and we have to think long and hard. Zika is a perfect example. We need to think long and hard. We also have those pictures of those bees that were killed, the millions of bees, when South Carolina was sprayed for Zika. Should we be spraying these toxic chemicals everywhere to eradicate mosquitoes? Should we come up, is the GMO mosquito a good idea? I don't have any answers, but there's a GMO mosquito that will effectively disarm the virus. If we release that into the environment, there's no going back. There's no going back. But we are presented with some very tough choices, and we need to ask these questions. Is it better to spray everywhere for Zika, or is it better to take the risk for microcephaly? Do we know how that pesticide affects babies in utero? Is it less dangerous than microcephaly? I don't have the answers. I'm not a scientist and I'm not a doctor, but I think we need to start on a national level having this discussion and asking these questions. So yes, the question of the GMO is we have these big three or four crops. Also, another one that really concerns me is the GMO tree or eucalyptus tree in particular. We have cut down large swaths of jungle and forest, particularly in South America, and we're growing GMO eucalyptus trees to make biobricks. These are Jonathan Franzen in a terrific piece in The New Yorker called them sterile unforests. And just imagine these were forests, jungles that were teeming with life, and they were raised to grow these highly sprayed forests that were going to use the wood for biobricks. Our thirst for more and more and more, and always to eradicate and cut down and grow something that we think that we've engineered to be better, we have to look at this, I think, quite seriously.
So let's switch the conversation to Europe. Europe takes a whole different view of this than we do. And you have a great, you traveled to Europe and you met with some beekeepers. It's a great part of the book, your trip to Germany and Brussels. And so what did you learn about what Europe is thinking about GMOs and what they're doing? And why are they so different than we are?
Well, that was what was so revelatory to me. So I went to Europe and I kept hearing everywhere. I kept hearing from people, they do it so much better in Europe. It's so much better in Europe. And this sort of grass is greener idea. And I got there and I realized that there were a lot of loopholes in their policy as well and a lot of questionable things. But I look at that in the second section of the book, which is called Honey, The Other Side of the Atlantic, through the lens of bees and honey. And I traveled through Europe with some beekeepers and listened to their concerns. And in one case, a beekeeper whose honey had been contaminated with GMO pollen, but I also listened to their concerns about honey and hives and bees being contaminated with pesticides and how it's affecting the bees. And so I use honey and bees really as the lens, and it becomes a real metaphor for the whole book for me. So that's sort of the heart of the book. It truly is the middle of the book, and it becomes the heart of the book. And I investigate the differences and try to hold them up against each other between America and Europe.
Mm-hmm. But they have banned GMOs, right, in Europe, just about everywhere?
No, it's not. It's more complicated than that.
Okay.
There are, Spain and Portugal grow tons of GMO crops.
Right, okay.
There are loopholes, like the for animal feed, trade alliances, things like that have created, it's more complicated.
Okay.
Than we think.
Yeah, right.
Than even the European people actually think. Yeah.
Because those companies are multinational, international companies. They're selling seed. And
absolutely. I mean, so glyphosate, for instance, was on the road to being banned in the EU. And there are some countries that have said no more glyphosate. Well, just this June, due to pressure from the multinational companies, in particular from Monsanto, now it looks like maybe they're going to take another look. It was suspended. Glyphosate is no longer going to be banned. You know, this is the same story that keeps being played out.
So now that you've written this book and you're on the road talking about it, are you going to continue this quest to be an activist? Do you consider yourself an activist?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't. I mean, that's the thing. So when I was writing this book, when I started this book, I was a person who was writing this little journal. I called it Sick. And in fact, my husband took some beautiful photographs of it, and it's on my website. And I just was writing down like what was wrong with me. I was a new mother. I felt sidelined as a mother. My hands really hurt. They would sort of curl up at night. And my husband would make me these splints out of cardboard and tape to keep my hands flat so they wouldn't do that. Mm. And I had a hard time buttoning my son's sweaters. And I just felt really desperate. And then I got this, like, take GMOs out of your diet, GMO corn, because it's everywhere. And I didn't even know what a GMO was. And I was 75 pages into a novel that I was really enjoying writing. Just sort of like, oh, gosh. So I tried to figure out what a GMO was, and I opened up this closet, and I kind of peered in. It's like, let me shut that door as fast as I don't want to know any of this. And I was like, well, I should just look in, you know, just for myself and my own children, because that's really all it comes down to, right? I look in, I was like, ah, oh, geez. There's a bigger thing here. And I was like, well, let me just close it again and I'll just go back to the novel. And so what happened then was 5.5 years, while my husband worked many various jobs to support us, while I was on this thing interviewing these people and trying to figure this question out. And I'm really, you know, I'm an unlikely person, an accidental activist, if anything. I'm a romantic writer. I want to write about love and heartbreak and kitchen table problems. And somehow
this is sort of all of that, you know.
This became my kitchen table problem, and my heart broke over what we're doing to the environment with these crops. How we've plowed up the prairie, raised forest, cut down trees, diminished, you know, wetlands, filled them in. My heart broke when I was working on this book, what we're doing to the natural world. People are saying now who are studying this that neonicotinoids, which are the seed treatments, are as dangerous as DDT to birds, to aquatic wildlife. You know, when is enough going to be enough? In my son's lifetime, we may lose polar bears. We may lose moose. We may lose the monarch butterfly. We may lose the honeybee. It just, you know, it goes on and on. And when is it going to be enough? And so, yes, my heart was broken. And I felt for my own children, but also for your children. I had to continue to stick my head in that dark closet. And I just don't know that I could have not. Am I going to stay on this topic? I don't know. The book is out there. There's nothing I can do. I can't push rewind. I think it's an important topic to talk about. I'll probably bore everyone to tears for years with this topic, but I do hope at some point to get back to writing fiction and writing those kitchen table problems, and perhaps my next kitchen table problem, unfortunately, will interrupt the next novel. Which may never see the light of day. I don't know.
Well, we have time for one last question. And I'm wondering, what advice can you give to the audience here and listening if they want to be healthier? And even though the science isn't definite, what can they do to change the way they eat now to prevent any future health problems?
I think the most important thing to do, as I've said, is to eat organic. And I realize there are economic barriers. However, when you choose organic, you are also making a difference to the environment as well as to your own health. And I think that's what one thing you can do. I think you can also talk to your farmers. One woman said today that, you know, the farmers markets in California, which I didn't know, are expensive. You can't necessarily buy tomato seconds from a farmer, especially if you're in a more, but she was saying that the Safeway has organic and you can go there. You know, the thing is that you should support the Safeway's choice to carry those organic products, because some guy either in California or woman or in the Middle West or in Mexico or somewhere is choosing against all odds to grow that organic romaine lettuce. And right next to them, they may have somebody, you know, or a mile down the road spraying the bejesus out of their lettuce. but this person has taken this stand. You should support them. It's very important to do this. So, you know, again, how we choose our food is actually an incredibly political choice. So I think it's important.
Okay. Well, our thanks to author Caitlin Shetterly for coming to talk to us about her new book, Modified, GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. I'm Kathy Curtis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.